Welcome to Everyone Loved It But Me. My name is Lisa Hedger. I am your host. I'm a freelance writer, editor, and journalist in Central Ohio. This is the podcast where we offer up unique opinions on beloved books. And today's podcast is a little bit different. Rather than having a deep dive analysis on one particular book, I'm going to talk about some unpopular book opinions, some that I have myself, and also some from folks within the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page. So this is going to be a really fun episode. I'm very excited about it. Before I jump in, please follow me wherever you listen to podcasts. In most cases, you can just click the little arrow or the little plus button. I would really appreciate it. Now, on to the show. Today's episode is definitely embracing differences of opinions, which is what this podcast is all about. The episode today is unpopular bookish opinion. This is going to range from, you know, bookish related things related to certain covers, the way books are written, to, of course, specific books. But it will be a list. Some of these are going to be my unpopular opinions. Some will be ones that I've seen on the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page. I'll talk about that, and others that I've read about. The first one, this is a very, very unpopular opinion, but I am not a huge fan of the stickers for the very popular celebrity book clubs like Reese and Jenna and Oprah, and there's a bunch more that are permanently affixed to the covers of books. Like, for instance, I've got this beautiful, beautiful cover, this beautiful book, which is called Hello Beautiful, right? It's Anne Napolitano. And right in the middle of it is a permanent sticker about a celebrity book club. And it's just a little annoying. I am not a huge fan of it. I would have preferred that on the back or on the spine of the book, not right in the middle of this cover. I totally understand. I think authors probably will disagree with me because it's a badge of honor. They will argue that is how they can get readers, is because of these celebrity book clubs. It's interesting, as I was coming up with this list, I started wondering, like, oh, am I alone on this? I probably am. I will tell you, everyone's going to get a kick out of this. I did find on change.org, there was a petition back in 2020 to stop printing book club stickers directly onto book covers. Okay, that made me feel a little bit better. I got a real, real kick out of that. And this particular document actually says, you know, online retailers are displaying covers of books free of these brandings, but are shipping out ones that include them. Many brick and mortar stores only have the book club copies in stock. All we're asking is that consumers be given the option to opt out of these marketing ploys by either returning to actual stickers or having an option to buy a copy without one. I think that's a good point. I will say, now this is an interesting, again, this is a little controversial, right? I will say, when I see an award sticker on the book, right, that book has won a Caldecott, let's say, or a Newbery, or a Pulitzer, that doesn't bother me as much. And then I was trying to figure out, like, why is that? Because it should bother me the same amount, I think. I found a Publishers Weekly article, I will include this in the show notes, that was literally just titled, "Where Should the Caldecott Sticker Go? Where Should It Be Placed?" And that the Caldecott is a very, very important, like, youth award. Here's a description. It says, 2 inches in diameter, in all its golden glory, the Caldecott medal seal signifies the artist of the most distinguished American picture book for children. This is the artist. And it goes on to say, yet the fancy embossed metallic label, a sticker applied by hand, not inked on, takes up real estate on a picture book cover and often obscures part of the artist's work. We asked creative teams to share how they negotiate the precise location of the seal. Now, that's interesting. That one they're saying, did you pick up on that? It says a sticker applied by hand. Again, the book that I'm looking at right now, Hello Beautiful, the one I just mentioned that has the, this is Oprah's Book Club 2023. It is fixed on here. I cannot take it off. It's, the sticker is part of the cover. It's so funny with the Caldecott. Someone said, I mean, who's complaining? Asked Brodem Moscovich, editorial director of Knopf Books for Young Readers, who edited author illustrator Doug Salati's 2023 Caldecott medal winning book Hot Dog. The seal affects the original composition, Moscovich said, but we're so happy to have this beacon shining on the jacket, attracting library patrons and bookstore browsers. I think I would agree with that. I like that a sticker, when a book has won an award, I like that. So, and I like that you can kind of take it on or off. I don't like that it's permanently affixed. And then another unpopular opinion was, some people said they like paperbacks they think are easier to read than hardbacks. I think that can be the case. I've got to tell you, if a book is so heavy that I can't even read it in bed, I have to make a change. Like, I have to move it to some kind of, you know, really, really like a Kindle. And the book that I'm thinking of was Truman, which David McCullough book, read some years ago, I think before audio was really popular. It was just shy of 1,000 pages. I think it was like around 992 pages. I could not even like read it in bed. It was hard for me to read it in bed. And that unpopular opinion, it's not, did I think it was too long? Honestly, yes, I do think Truman was too long. It was. However, if I can't just physically read it, that was a problem. Okay, here is another, we will call it another unpopular opinion. Peggy posted this one on the Facebook page. She's a wonderful contributor. One of her pet peeves she posted is kind of like the cartoonish art. The example she used was Much Ado About You by Samantha Young. And she said, I find so many new books with cover art like this. I find them suspicious and won't read them. I know, crazy. I frequently read a book because of the cover. Well, she's not alone. Many of us do, right? And she was also saying, you know, she's attracted to certain covers, as we all are. Give me a nicely detailed cover, one with a girl in a house and I'm in heaven. And she included some pictures of covers that are really, really lovely, such as The Birdcage. She brought up a really good point when she brought up these kind of cartoonish covers. I thought to myself, wait a minute, she's right. I am seeing so many cartoonish covers lately. It got me going down that a little bit of a rabbit hole, if you will. And I found this list of so many popular cartoonish covers. I found this article. This is in Pace. I will include this article in the show notes. This was just published February 1st of this year. The headline is, Why Does Every Romance Novel Have the Same Cartoon Cover Right Now? The three books on here are The Perfect Play by J.C. Burton, The Last Single Cowboy by Jamie Casey, Faking with Benefits by Lily Gould, and those are just three examples. There's actually many, many more out there. I would say several we've discussed on the podcast. The Hating Game that I discussed on the podcast, that I would argue definitely that cartoonish cover. Also discussed The Love Hypothesis, also for sure cartoonish. Honeymooners, kind of cartoonish. Beach Read, have not discussed that yet on the podcast. I want to. Red, White, and Royal Blue, also kind of in that cartoonish category, if you will. Let me see. Going to this article, like I said, it starts out and says, if you're a romance reader or you've been in the vicinity of a bookstore anytime over the past couple of years, you're probably familiar with this trend. Go to the display with a sign reading some variation of Book Talk Made Me Buy It. For plenty of examples, you'll see a slew of titles that are identical in terms of pure marketing, all adorned with a cute cartoon cover of a romantic pair about to make mischief. The designs are simple, the kind of artwork that is straightforward in an aesthetic but readily charming. Maybe one of the loving pairs leaning against the title to demonstrate their sassy attitude. Whether they're sports people, bakers, royals, travelers, or part of some other quirky occupation, they are the same. Sorry, beefcakes and flowing skirts, the cartoon cover is in charge of romance right now. And that is 100% honest. It says marketing shifts are hard to ignore and even harder to stay apart from when you're pushing your product. When something is in, be it a genre or author, everyone else wants to keep up. And you can see this now. For instance, they even pointed out the cartoon cover is hardly the first example of this move either. When Twilight took over the world, many books, including some literary classics, got re-released with that minimalist black, white, and red covers designed to deliberately evoke the Stephanie Meyer's work. That's how we ended up with copies of Wuthering Heights and Anne Rice's back catalog designed to be casually confused with the sparkling brethren they inspired. Classic literature goes through this all the time. But now we're at this point where it's these cartoon covers. So Rachel Ake Cuke of Random House told Eye on Design, the current book cover trend is highly influenced by what publishers and sales teams think is, quote, Instagram friendly. And deciding on a cover often means looking at what everyone else is doing, slotting your title into that style. If something looks good, it plays well on social media, which has become an increasingly crucial part of the promotional cycle. BookTok alone has accounted for so much in modern romance sales, and there, the cartoons are popular. They seem universally appealing, non-threatening, and unabashedly feminine. For many readers new to romance, an illustrated couple seems far less intimidating to a first-time reader than a shirtless hunk in a clinch pose with his love interest. So I think that's right. Like, I think if you really don't like a ton of spicy, like if you're like, nope, no thank you on spicy, I think when you see these cartoonish covers, then you might be like, oh, that's not going to be so spicy. That's not going to be a heavy, heavy, you know, level of like intense spice that I'm not into. That'll be perfect. So I think based on that article, like I said, I'll include all of it in the show notes, but we are going to see more of these covers. And why are we going to see more of these covers? Because they sell books right now, right? Just like I said about the stickers sell books, and so do these kind of covers. I kind of get a kick out of these particular kind of covers. I mean, I remember again when the days of romance from like the 90s and early 2000s, when it was always the hunky hunky men and women scantily clad. So I kind of get a kick out of the cartoon covers. It doesn't bother me as much as others, but I do think this is going to be a trend that we're going to see. Another trend I know some people hate is when the book cover is changed to the movie again. We're not going to see that change because it helps to sell books, right? It absolutely helps to sell books. So now here's a super, super unpopular one. And I will say, I think this has probably only happened to me just a handful of times where I feel like the movie is better than the book. I would say it's very, very, very rare that this has happened. I do think that it can happen. I think that there are times, for instance, if you watch the movie first and then read the book, then I think it's hard to really decide which one you like better. So that happened to me when I discussed Skipping Christmas in December of 2023, which comes from the movie Christmas with the Cranks, because I actually watched that movie many times before I read the book. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure that I thought the movie was that much better, but there are parts of the movie that I liked better than the book. And then here's another one that is just a complete kind of unpopular opinion. Not only do I believe that audio is fine and that I believe that audio counts as a book, But I actually believe sometimes audio is better than the actual book. And, you know, again, there's just a couple select examples. I've talked a lot about, you know, Trevor Noah, Born a Crime. I think that's a really good example. There are times I just read How to Be Perfect by Michael Schur. Michael Schur is a guy who is, you know, creator, producer for The Office, for The Good Place, for Parks and Recreation. And this particular book that he wrote, a lot of it has to do with how he wrote The Good Place. So it's all about philosophical debate. It's all about certain scenarios. Like, he goes down these really big, long rabbit holes on, okay, should you, if you're at the grocery store, should you return the cart to the cart area? Well, quite frankly, I thought we had decided eons ago that yes, that is the polite thing to do. But anyway, he goes down these long rabbit holes from a philosophical standpoint, debating how you should act, how you should handle certain scenarios. And I gotta tell you, I started to read that book and I don't know if I could have gotten through it. Now, listening to it, right? Listening to it, you actually had some of the actors' voices from The Good Place. Ted Danza and several of the other actors would kind of step in and give a couple quotes and things like that. And it really brought that book alive. That book is a deep dive, philosophical, kind of a harder read, pondering all these different questions and things like that. So yeah, for that one, the audio for me was way, way better. So I do believe that. That's one of my unpopular opinions. Yes, the audio can be better. And another unpopular opinion, I think, is that you don't have to read the classics. I've heard people say, like, oh, I'll never take your opinion seriously if you don't read the classics. And then that goes back to the other unpopular opinion, which is, what is the definition of a classic? And we all know that a classic, the definition of a classic changes based on who is building and creating the list. Deb on the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page just wrote, I just reread The Scarlet Letter. I'm kind of questioning why it's deemed a classic. My college daughter, Liz, when she read it a few years ago in high school, I believe she had the same question. And we talked about that as well. Heather and I, when we discussed, Heather Leip and I, who was my guest in How Green Was My Valley in, I think, summer of 2023, we discussed that How Green Was My Valley was kind of considered a classic, but we also have the same debates, like, should that be a classic? I know when I've discussed also the book Stoner, I believe both How Green Was My Valley and Stoner are kind of like overlooked classics, but still in the classic genre. And then there's a lot of classics out there. You know, I hear people debate about the Jane Austen. I hear so much debate about, like, what is a classic and you need to read all of these classics. And so I just think that's kind of silly. I always say, read what brings you joy. There are certain books that are on lists and I think, well, maybe I should read them. Sometimes I do. And then I am woefully disappointed. Now, Marsha on the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page, she has a great unpopular opinion. She says, and I tend to agree with this, the whole issue of, like, kind of writing a sequel just to write it. And her case in point was Divergent. She said how much she and her kids loved the first book, but the second book could barely get through and didn't even touch the third book. I don't know that that's just for the sake of writing it. I think that, again, goes back to financial means. I think that if the first book does really, really well, then people, publishers, and everyone saying you've got to write another one. Now, I would argue that we should see a little more. I mean, if you want to keep that alive, I like the idea of spreading it out to kind of a new series, a series adjacent, or even doing a prequel. Right? With the Hunger Games, they just did that prequel. I have not read the prequel yet, but I've heard really, really good things about it. So I think that that's something really to keep in mind. We don't always need a sequel. And if that author is super brilliant and bright and they have written amazing books, then, like, let them go off and do another book, right? Let them go do something else completely creative and unique. Of course, I always talk about, you know, the unpopular opinion that it's okay to not like all of the popular books, because that is the whole point of my podcast, which is it's okay to have different opinions. And everyone loved it, but me Facebook page was starting to talk about like, okay, I'm not a huge fan of Midnight Library. You'll recall we discussed Midnight Library on the podcast. A lot of discussion on the Facebook page about Lessons in Chemistry. That is still one to this day I discussed on the podcast as well. If you'll recall, or you can check out that episode, there were parts of Lessons in Chemistry I like. I did feel like it was exaggerated. The dog, the voice of the dog, is very controversial in Lessons in Chemistry. I think I was okay with the voice of the dog in the book, but I didn't like it in the movie, which is really interesting to me. A lot of people on the Facebook page were saying, oh my gosh, I did not like that at all. But like Diane writes and says, since I lived most of the experiences and lessons in chemistry, I find it hard to understand any negative or doubting comments. And someone else said, well, I don't want to be negative. I just didn't love it like I expected to as a fellow woman in science. Jennifer writes that. And then a lot of people said that inner dialogue of the dog took me out of the story every single time. And that is so interesting because a dog's voice or a cat's voice, I mean, it can be very, very controversial to readers. It either calls to you or it pulls you away. So I thought that is I don't know how much of an unpopular opinion that is about the dog voices, but definitely that is something that really can grate people's nerves. And I also feel like dog narrators, like I talked about this in The Art of Racing in the Rain, there were aspects of that book that I reread for the podcast for the second time that the dog just wouldn't have known, okay? So if you're going to have a dog narrator, you know, you needs to be consistent with information that a dog would know. Now, Betsy posted on the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page, I'm tired of books jumping back and forth in time. Sometimes I just want to start at the beginning of a story and go to the end, right? Like beginning, middle, and end. I hear her on that because the jumping around, and also it depends on how you are reading it. But I find myself sometimes just like going back to the beginning and trying, like looking at years, like what year are we? Is it 1920? Is it 2000? You know, and it goes, they jump, some of them jump around so much that I've had the same exact issue. Let me know what these are. Just kind of just a good list of some unpopular book opinions, some of the things that kind of drive some of us crazy. Let me know, what are the things that drive you crazy? What do you think that there's just something out there you're convinced you're the only one that feels that way? Reach out to me at www.everyonelovedibutme.com. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, it's now X, Instagram, of course, and LinkedIn. You can find me at Everyone Loved It But Me, or Lisa Hedger, H-E-D as in Daisy, G-E-R. Love to talk books, and these are the kind of conversations we are having on the Everyone Loved It But Me Facebook page as well, and also on Instagram, a lot of these types of conversations, and some conversations even on LinkedIn as well. We'll talk about these kind of things. So please reach out to me. I want to thank you so much for listening to the show. I really appreciate your listenership. I hope that you have a lovely day. Most importantly, I hope you get time to read today.